طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we take a long look at the Palestinian struggle within the context of Israel's recent campaign to normalize relationships with a myriad of Arab states. We feature a conversation with Grant Smith of the Washington Report on Middle East and Professor of Political Science at California State University, Asad Khalil. As you will hear, Professor Khalil, a Palestinian raised in Lebanon, has deep roots within the Middle East and interesting observations on the politics of the region. It begins with his discussing his early involvement with the struggle for Palestinian rights.
I started as a very young left-wing activist, very close to the Palestinian resistance movement in Lebanon. This I'm talking about when I was 15 and 16, and I was very much drawn to the ideas of revolution by people like George Habash and many others and so on. And then I left Lebanon after the devastating Israeli invasion of Lebanon of 1982. For me, the issue is not intellectual. It is really personal and obviously emotional. I never visited the apartheid state, the occupied Palestinian territories, but the Israeli apartheid state visited me repeatedly during my childhood. I am originally from the southern city of Tyre, even though I grew up in Beirut. And it is without exaggeration that any time we went to see my grandmother in the city of Tyre, where she lived in one of the oldest houses in the entire city, and it was bombed directly three times over the years. Three times. It's now in disrepair. There are signs around it. You cannot climb the stairs to see images of my memories and so on. Israel has repeatedly invaded Lebanon over the years that I was growing up. Every visit was characterized by an Israeli raid, bombing campaign, encroachment. Israelis dispatched a team into Lebanon and kidnapped Lebanese people and so on. Palestinian refugee camps were repeatedly bombed from the air during my childhood. Mm-hmm. I was 15 years old when Israel repeatedly bombed a refugee camp in southern Lebanon that doesn't exist anymore. People do not remember that there was a refugee camp in the city of Nabatiyye, which is in South Lebanon, because the repeated bombing campaigns by Israel rendered the place inhabitable. Israel literally incinerated the Palestinian refugee camp in Nabatiyye. So after miraculously surviving the Israeli invasion, where I came close to death repeatedly, I came to America in 1983, and I was going to school at Georgetown at the time for my graduate degree. And I lived in Washington, D.C. for several years. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, I taught at Georgetown. And then I went elsewhere in America and came back to Washington in 1992, 93. So I have been around the Washington scene, and I have seen the Israeli lobby and its rivals. And I have seen how the rivals have been totally been defeated by by an order of the Gulf government after 1991. And it is remarkable that there are still brave voices left. Washington Report is among them, because Arab American organizations were killed. They were the allies of the Washington Report. They had joint conferences together, and the same people who attended the conference of the Washington Report attended the ADC and others.
Right.
And all that have been killed, because up until 1991, the Gulf governments invested in Arab American organizations, because at the time, while they never contributed meaningfully to the Arab-Israeli conflict, they basically were upset by the Israeli lobby because it lobbied against their getting arms. And, you know, there were famous battles in Congress in the 1980s about American arms sale to Saudi Arabia or UAE and so on. Mm-hmm. So there were these clashes. The clashes between Gulf despots and the Israeli lobby were never about Palestine.
Right.
It was about Gulf despots wanting to get close to Washington and obtaining the arms purchases that they desired over the years. After the Israeli invasion of Kuwait, the American made a very clear bargain with the Gulf despot. It said, no more advocacy for the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. You cut off any funding for the Palestinian organization, PLO. And they were contributing money to the PLO, not in any way out of sympathy for the Palestinian, but particularly in order, one, to sway the PLO in a very conservative direction, which led us to the disastrous road to Oslo. And two, they were paying as a way to save their necks. I mean, they wanted to pay the PLO leadership in order that no Palestinian organizations ever operated in Gulf territories. That was the bargain. After 1991, James Baker and the George Herbert Walker Bush administration told them enough of that, cut off all funding to the PLO, no more advocacy, and they were more than happy to start the beginning of a honeymoon with the Israeli government and with the Israeli lobby. It started as early as then.
Wow.
So the announcement, the dramatic declarations about
Right. Organization
and so on, I mean, there's nothing surprising about that. And let us also remember...
It's already going on.
...covert cooperation between Gulf despots and Israel throughout the 1960s and 70s. Remember, they both, just like today, they share an enemy called the Iranian government and its allies. They back then shared a common enemy, communism, socialism, and the government of Nasser. I mean, these governments were frightened that there was a man in Egypt preaching social justice, feminism, Arab unity, defiance against imperialism, and solidarity with third world causes. These were anathema, and still are, to the Gulf despots. So the Gulf despots were opposed to any real liberation movement throughout the region. They fought against them, and they collaborated with America against progressive movements worldwide. I mean, the Saudis even contributed money to American covert operation against the Italian Communist Party, because elections back then, talk about rigging elections, the United States repeatedly rigged elections in Western European countries to prevent the rise of the left. They were supporting the Christian Democrat in Italy. So the Saudis were aiding in that regard. And in the war in Yemen in 1960s, which the United States used, just like the war in Afghanistan, to exhaust and fatigue an enemy, and that then was Nasser, the Israelis collaborated with the Saudis in the awful war in Yemen, in which the Western world, unsurprisingly, were on the side of the reactionary feudal monarchist forces along with Gulf regimes and Israel. And mm-hmm. Nasser was supporting a progressive Republican movement and secular movement in Yemen. So that's the background to the story.
That's, okay.
After 1991, the Gulf government decided to kill Arab advocacy in Washington, D.C.
When you mentioned it was literal killing, would you include Alex O'Day there in California where you are?
Well, up until that point, the Gulf despots were pretending that they support the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
And they would make financial contribution to Arab American organizations like ABC, NAAA, National Association of Arab Americans, even though they preferred the latter because it was more conservative and preaching economic enterprise, capitalism, and so on. And there were attempts to create alternative Arab American organizations, like after 1967, Edward Said and Ibrahim Abulughad, among others, created an alternative progressive, and that is the AAUG, Arab American University Graduate, even though I didn't like the scope of that organization because it only appealed to university graduates, mm-hmm. leaving behind all these Arab American workers in the auto industry in Detroit and farm workers, Yemenis in California and so on. But that's a different story. So yeah, they killed Arab American organization, and also it coincided with the rise of Islamic movement. So Sunnis and Shiites were less drawn to a secular Arab American organization, mm-hmm. and they were forming their own Islamist religious-oriented organization. And I believe that to be have been an unfortunate development, because there is no doubt that when Arabs were organized along secular lines, they were far more effective as a force. They were not beset by sectarian religious differences, and they really were able to center on the issue of Palestine. That is no more the case. Today there's fragmentation, and not only that, you have now Gulf despot openly advocating for Israel. So as a result, if you want to speak for Palestine, mm-hmm. that organization does, if you want to speak out against the Israel lobby, you are on your own. There is no support. And remember, there were Arab embassies at the time who also supported Arab American advocacy, like the Algerian embassy, the Iraqi embassy, and so on. And those are totally gone. None of them want to upset the Americans and the U.S. government decide what is an acceptable cause and what is not. And certainly Palestine never was, is not today, and will never be for the American government an acceptable cause. What they want is, in the name of the peace process, is to smash Palestinian national aspirations. And I don't care if the government is Republican or Democrat. It doesn't make a difference to me.
Well, we have plenty of time to get into this amazingly detailed example that you give. But I do want to mention, you know, this seems to be a recurrent theme. There was this incredible organization, the Organization of Arab Students, OAS, that came up in the 60s and was organizing conferences and was very dedicated, again, and what you say, the kind of a secular approach to pushing back against a lot of these policies. They didn't appear to be, you know, they were talking to Palestinian groups and whatnot, but they did not appear to be the cat's paw of anybody. And of course, they were infiltrated and shut down. So it's an amazing...
That footnote, you mentioned our Organization for Arab Students.
Yeah.
And not only they were sabotaged and they were infiltrated and they were fought and so on, it was a really radical organization. This was before my time, mind you. Mm-hmm. I came to America, I was 23, and that was 1983. Before my times, there was Organization of American Students. The story about this organization of Arab students was told in the book by Elias Choufani, who was a radical Palestinian intellectual. He studied in the United States, was active in the United States, and then went back and was an official in the Palestinian organization, and then defected after 1982 and was involved with more radical Palestinian groups and so on. So he tells the story. The man at the behest of Yasser Arafat, who killed Arab student organizations fighting for Palestine, was none other than Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen. This guy basically said, we don't want Arab student organizing anymore. You know why? Because those students were criticizing the early signs of accommodationist solutions to the cause, peace agreements with Israel and the two-state solution and so on. They were very alarmed about that. And because Abu Mazen and Arafat were already planning that disastrous direction, they killed Arab students. They really killed that organization. And as a result, Arab students became splintered the way they are now. So you go on college campuses now, you find Lebanese student Tabbouleh. You find Syrian organization, Moroccan, and so on. I mean, it was fragmented. This was done by Mahmoud Abbas and by Yasser Arafat on purpose. What you also find today is that, in addition to the fragmentation of Palestinian student activism, is that as a result of that, BDS came forward. BDS is really the alternative for the vacuum that was left by the dissolution, not only of Arab American organization on college campuses, but also of the Arab student associations of different stripes.
Okay, well, I just want to add that the ADL also heavily infiltrated the Organization of Arab Students, and a number of documents came out about that appeared on the Electronic Intifada. But I really want to get the name of that book for the show notes, because I've never heard of that, and I'd love to read it if there's
any. The
book you quoted about the disappearance of the OAS.
Too funny. And there's a good documentary by his daughter about his life. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we want to get into, though, and I'm just going to put it up here so everyone can see it, this really incredible article that you wrote about today's topic, which is, of course, normalization and this incredible drive that we now see for normalization being led by the U.S., being led by Israel. So it was October 2020 over at Consortium News, the great Consortium News. It was titled, "The U.S. Just Blackmailed Sudan." And you go back into the history of U.S. Cold War intrigues in Sudan. And the piece was, of course, subtitled, "Washington has proven that it is willing to make people suffer and even starve if governments don't acquiesce to normalization with Israel." So I'm wondering if you could, again, to add to this incredible detail you've just given, talk about the Cold War history of the U.S. and Sudan and this shift away to the point where now they're in a normalization process.
Well, one of the myths about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is that the United States only visited upon the region and inflicted harm on them after September 11 in response to the bombing. The United States never left the Middle East to return to the Middle East. The United States has been in the Middle East since World War II, uninterruptedly. The United States is the official sponsor of the Arab tyrannical order. The United States, if you want to tick off reasons and causes for the perpetuation of the lack of democracy in the region, there is no question that you have to put the United States and Western governments in the top of the list as factors preventing democracy. The United States not only does not support democracy in the region, the United States will fight tooth and nail against true democratization in the region. And I don't care whether the president is Obama or Trump, it makes very little difference. And whatever criminal aspect we complain about regarding the Trump administration and the cruel sanctions that are being inflicted on the people, not the regime. American government always inflicted harm on people and presented it as if it is targeted, deliberately targeted against the ruler and his wife. The sanctions that are in name against Bashar al-Assad and his wife are really hurting the average population. I am sure, the ruler of Syria is not eating any less, but the Syrian people are eating less food. They are eating less meat. They are having less nutrition in their daily intake and so on. The same thing about the sanctions against Venezuela or against Iran and so on. It is always infliction on the people. And this started throughout the years of the Cold War and certainly was engineered to a higher degree of criminality by the Clinton administration with the massive, savage sanctions that were imposed on the people of Iraq. And we all remember how Madeleine Albright, this liberal democratic voice on foreign policy, famously said that it was all worth it, even if it resulted in the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi people. So in the Cold War, the United States was the official sponsor of most of the regime. The United States only fought and only brought up human rights and lack of democracy in government that did not toe the line. Any tyrant that follows U.S. dictates and Israeli dictates would be forgiven for all their massive human rights violations. This is true about Morocco, true about Tunisia for all these years, true about Egypt since 1970, true about Jordan, true about all the Gulf governments and so on. And it continues to this very day. Look at the Libyan dictator Gaddafi, for example. Before 2011, for several years prior, because he surrendered all his weapons of mass destruction program to the American, he became very close to the Westerners. He was visited by, Condoleezza Rice. Tony Blair went and visited him in his tent. And we should not remember that he even dispatched the head of the secret police of Libya and was met with great fanfare and ceremonial bombast at the State Department when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State for Barack Obama. But of course, when the opportunity arose, they could not resist and they brought down the government, hoping to get a much friendlier client regime in Libya. And look at the devastation of Libya. Obama has the blood of the Libyan people on his hand. This is one of the worst adventures of the Obama administration and of recent American policy. Look at the liberal media and their complaint about Trump. As much as Trump is responsible for so much of the civilian suffering in Libya as well as in Iraq, as well as in Syria, Iran, and so on. But there's no question that Obama and Bush launched more Middle Eastern wars than Trump. But if you hear the liberal media complain, you would think that things were so peaceful and so wise under the Obama and the Bush administrations. So in the Cold War, the United States created a system of tyrannical regime whereby the United States would either finance or would finance and arm Arab governments, or in the case of the Gulf, they would take their money and they would shower them with weapons, and they were dumping weapons throughout the Middle East on client regime. Look at Somalia. Somalia today, the wars in Somalia were directly the result of how this little small poor country was used by the U.S. cynically during the Cold War against the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. The same can be said now about what happened to Libya, and how much weapons were dumped there. And the same about in Syria. I mean, so the United States and Israel were involved in all our conflict, either instigating them or once they started, they threw heavily in them. The United States and Israel invested in the war in Sudan against the government of Sudan. They invested in the war in Lebanon, the long year of the civil war, on the side of the right-wing fascists. They invested, of course, in the Kurdish question in Iraq against the Iraqi government. Of course, they invested in the Iran-Iraq war as well because they wanted to bleed both governments. This is what a conflict that Henry Kissinger said, that this is a conflict in which he wants both sides to be defeated. And that was a recipe for the prolongation of the war for 8 years and the death of a million people and the injury of hundreds of thousands of others. I mean, this is the bloody history of America's involvement in the Middle East, which started far longer than September 11.
Sure. And in the case of Sudan, again, the point that you were making there, which I found to be particularly interesting, is that in this most recent iteration of these trends where the U.S. is never really supporting any sort of grassroots or popular resistance, it's always on the side of these entrenched forces. But you state that in the case of Sudan, they were under these crushing economic sanctions premised on the fact that the entire country, again, with the, you know, lower income average person bearing the brunt of it, these incredible sanctions because of Osama bin Laden's presence in that country for some period of time.
Right.
And so take us through this kind of cynical, you call it blackmail. It looks like blackmail, right, where the U.S. is going to lift these sanctions in exchange for this favor.
Right. Well, I mean, the story of Sudan is an old one. As I mentioned in my article, when I grew up, Sudan was one of the really democratic countries of the region. It was one of the few true democracies in the Middle East, because, of course, Israel was an apartheid and is an apartheid state that doesn't fit the bill of the democracy in the Middle East and so on. And Lebanon was quasi-democratic, but Sudan was far ahead. And the intellectual life of Sudan was extremely impressive. And they had so many political parties competing from Islamists as well as the communists. And the Communist Party of Sudan in the 1960s was one of the largest parties in the entire Middle East. So after 1970, 1971, the communists were becoming much more powerful. They became a threat to the dictator of Sudan, who previously posed as being a progressive ally of Nasser. But 1970, Nasser was dead. So as a result, many of these leaders that looked up to Nasser were fending on their own to try to stay in power by any means necessary. Mm-hmm. And they were basically trying to sell themselves to the highest bidder. And the highest bidder was always the United States. So the dictator of Sudan, Jafar Numeri, imposed a draconian rule and massacred any opponents of the regime, imposed a very tight religious government in the Sudan and so on. And that continued for all these years until he was overthrown in 1985. And the United States was very unhappy to see him gone. And then another dictator came in, and that's Omar Bashir, who stayed in power until last year. The last year, there was a democratic movement in Sudan, and the people of Sudan were claiming for democracy. But the United States was not going to allow that to happen because the military junta that rules Sudan is a guarantor for U.S. and Israeli interests. And the military junta of Sudan collaborated with Israel and America since the 1980s. And the United States invests heavily in them. And make no mistake about it, Grant, we have evidence of that. Mm-hmm. The notion that Obama supported democracy in the Middle East in the Arab Spring, and I hate that title, of course, it's not an Arab Spring where there's blood in the street, is absolutely inaccurate. The United States, in the case of Egypt, the United States, in the case of Tunisia, actually banked on the military to take over power. They did not want a transition to election. They fought against it. And we remember how Hillary Clinton, when it was very clear that America's favorite despot, Hosni Mubarak, who once was called by Joe Biden family, was no more able to stay in power, Hillary Clinton came with a formula in which it said he should be succeeded by Omar Suleiman, the chief of the secret police. This is like saying the best alternative to Hitler is Himmler, that it would be a savior for the Iraq, for the German people. So then the Egyptian people wouldn't go for that. So then they had election. And of course, then the UAE and the Saudis, and there's no doubt with American wink and nod, overthrew a freely elected, the first truly freely elected president of Egypt. And he was replaced by the General Sisi, who's in power now, because the military works very closely with the Israelis and the American. In Tunisia, they also tried to arrange for a military coup, but the chief of staff of the Tunisian army admitted that he was contacted by the American, but he said he wouldn't accept. And then there was elections. And of course, the Gulf despots and the American manipulated the election to make sure the right-wing conservative forces. And Tunisia really has not changed much. I mean, the reins of power remain in the hands of the powerful, rich, corporations, and Western interests are still in charge of the state of Tunisia. So in all those cases, and of course, in the case of Bahrain, the Saudi army intervened and crushed the rebellion there. So the story about bin Laden is interesting. Because bin Laden stayed briefly for a couple of years in Sudan, mm-hmm. and then he was kicked out of the country.
Right.
The United States found a reason to impose cruel sanctions on the people of Sudan because they said it sheltered bin Laden.
Right.
But bin Laden was sheltered for longer years in Saudi Arabia. How come there were no sanctions on the Saudi government? The Saudi government was an ally of bin Laden. There is not a single prince of Saudi Arabia, a king, since the 1980s, who has not known bin Laden personally. Bin Laden's terrorist activities in Afghanistan not only had the support and the blessing of the U.S. government, but also of the Saudi government as well. So why is there no sanctions against the Saudis and the American government, which directly supported and sponsored bin Laden in his terrorist years when he was fighting communists in Afghanistan and elsewhere?
Right.
So they use that as a pretext. And in the negotiation over the last year, they made normalization with Israel a reason, a condition.
Right.
That there would be no lifting of sanctions until yep. you surrender to Israel. They yeah. did the same with Lebanon, Grant, in 1983. They told Lebanon, we will not help Lebanon end its war unless it signs a peace treaty with Israel. And Lebanon did under duress in 1983. And that was using a puppet right-wing government that Israel imposed in Lebanon. But the people of Lebanon, of course, revolted within a year, overthrew that government or basically made it impotent. And then the peace agreement was thrown into the dustbin of history.
I want to just ask you something about that, because you're virtually the only place where I saw any reporting saying that there were Sudanese protests against normalization. Right. You know, we're not at the point of overthrow yet, and they received no media coverage. I guess, unfortunately, because it was press TV, mobile video or something.
Right. The quality of Western reporting in the Middle East has become pathetic.
Yeah, and I hope we get to that, because you had an excellent piece also on the profile of a better reportage in the region. But now I really want to go into depth, because the normalization drive, right. you did something really interesting, because it does have all of the attributes of a sales pitch. And so you mentioned two poles that were being unfurled across the region. And the first was very heavily used suddenly by Sky News Arabia across the entire region, the satellite network. And they were quoting Zogby Analytic polls about the levels of popular support for normalization, you know, as if public opinion really matters across this region. And they specifically cited a poll, and you wrote about it as well, a Zoghbi poll of 1,000 Israelis and 3,600 Arabs. Suddenly, it was getting this coverage, but there seemed to be two major problems that you alluded to. The first was that the figures couldn't possibly have been true, and that they may not have been all that representative given the sample size. And I just found this to be, because I'm a big fan of large representative polls, what was coming out of Sky News Arabia and as well the Israeli press was that there was this huge growing support for normalization of popular ties across the Arab region with Israel. And they were quoting 59% of Jordanians and Saudis, 58% of Egyptians, and 56% of residents of UAE support normalization with Israel. And I was knocked out by that because it was unlike anything I've ever seen. And clearly you were as well. And it turns out that they were flipping the results. They were actually quoting the undesirable as the desirable. In other words, the majority of opinion, even in the Zoghbi poll, was that most were opposed to it, except for UAE. And so it was interesting that, again, they made some quick corrections unannounced where they slotted in the Zoghbi figures showing majority opposition. But what you did, I thought, was something that doesn't happen very much. You actually went to the 2019-2020 Arab Opinion Index from the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies, which is a comprehensive poll. And just to compare it to the smaller sample size of the other poll, you know, almost 30,000 individual respondents, 13 countries, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Iraq, all of these countries with an extremely small margin of error. And in your article, you said this poll shows the real popular support for normalization. And in this case, the normalization recognition of Israel enjoyed no popular support across the region, including, you know, Saudi Arabia and some of the other countries. And the margins were much higher than the Zoghbi result. And the other thing that was interesting is this has been consistent year after year after year. So I just want to ask you, you quickly saw something wrong with this. It looked like, again, it couldn't possibly be true, and you made some comments about this. What do you make of these diametrically opposed polls?
Well, I mean, polls are an instrument of propaganda in today's world. In other words, government like the United States and Saudis and UAE, they are able to manufacture polls to sway public opinion, you see? I mean, that's the purpose of public opinion. I mean, public opinion can be used either to give you a reading of where the public stands on issues, but it can also be used in order to sway the public how they view things. And this is exactly what they did in the last few months. Just after the normalization was announced, suddenly, I don't know how fast they worked on that, right? They produced out of the blue two polls, one by the famous Washington Institute, which is the research lobby of the research instrument of the Israeli lobby. And of course, it was incongruence, showing less support for opposition to normalization. And the Zoghbi poll. But look, the Zoghbi brothers have been doing business with the UAE dictatorship for many years. So the UAE despots have been using Zoghbi polls in order to reinforce their own policies and to justify them and to propagandize along the lines of their policies for many years. So I was not surprised how the Zoghbi poll was used in this particular case. I follow public opinion surveys in the region for many years, and there is no question that the most comprehensive one, the most reliable by far, is the Arab Center one you just cited. Yeah. And it shows exactly what we have seen in public opinion surveys are even done locally, because there are also public opinion surveys conducted locally in Lebanon, locally in Jordan, locally in Egypt, and so on. But also look at the methodology. For example, the Zugby poll sometimes, or even the Washington Institute, they use a team of handlers to go to homes in Saudi Arabia and ask them, what do you think about normalization? And you have people from the working for the Saudi government watching what you say, knowing that in your UAE and Saudi Arabia, if you tweet against the government policy, you can have a sentence of 15 years in jail. So the conditions in which the polls are conducted are not free. So that casts great doubt on their efficacy or reliability. But there's also another measure, Brent, which is Jordan and Egypt are the two countries with the longest standing peace treaties with Israel. Where does normalization stand in both countries? And both of them are not democracies even. Mm-hmm. The people of Jordan and the people of Egypt, defying their own government, have adamantly and consistently refused any attempts at normalization.
Yeah.
If you see in Jordan or Egypt an Israeli product, basically there would be a spontaneous boycott of your store. Maybe they will burn down your store as well. Look what happened in Egypt only 2 weeks ago. One Egyptian actor that I've never heard of took a picture with an Israeli visiting UAE. And the picture was posted in social media. There was a storm throughout the Arab world. He was vilified everywhere. And the Egyptian syndicate of actors expelled him. He was not allowed to act in any movies anymore or plays or serials and so on. And he was forced to even produce a statement, I'm sure he was lying, that he didn't know that the guy was Israeli and he was confused and so on, because he was trying to find a way out of his own dilemma. That tells you where normalization with Israel stands. Mm-hmm. And no matter how much money and billions of dollars these Gulf despots spend in order to beautify the ugly face of apartheid Israel, the Arab people are not going to be misled, and their minds about Israel is not going to be changed on the basis of the wishes of polygamous rulers of the Gulf countries.
Well, there's something interesting that was at the tail end of that, again, long and comprehensive poll that I just wanted to put up and get your reaction to it. And that is, one of the major premises is that there's this widespread view in the region that Iran is the top threat that's going to unify these days, these Arab countries, the Gulf countries, and Israel, because Iran is such a dire, dire threat. And again, in the poll that you used, which is much more representative and has a much lower error rate, the top threat across the country, across the board, countries are Israel and the U.S. And right. Iran is in a, you know, somewhat distant third place. So what do you make of the just utter split between these rationalizations and particularly organizations like the Washington Institute and the Foundation for Defensive Democracies trying to make this stick?
I mean, Gulf regimes today are close allies of the Israeli lobby. There's no question about that. I mean, the lobbies for Saudi Arabia and the lobbies for UAE in Washington, D.C. are mere arms of APAC. I mean, they work very closely together. The UAE ambassador is, now out in the open in his alliance with the Israeli interests in Washington, D.C. And I have to say that the results of what you suggested have been proven before, which is polls after polls show that Arabs still consider Israel to be the biggest threat to them and the United States as well. Also, I want to add, because I wrote a very lengthy study a few years ago about the Arab Center polls, this most comprehensive survey that I said is much more representative. They have their own problems as well. Like sometimes they contract out some of the polls in some countries, like in Lebanon and elsewhere and so on. And I am not don't have much confidence in some of these subcontractors that they do their work and so on. So there are some methodological problems, but in the absence of better alternatives, I say this one is, as far as I'm concerned, the best measure of Arab public opinion today.
Okay. Well, I also wanted to get into, for whatever its faults, the reasons why the public opinion in the country is trending so strongly against normalization. And this is what they listed in that. And maybe you can reflect on whether it sounds accurate or not, given your analysis of the Arab Center. But they're saying these are the reasons why they don't want normalization, particularly before a peace deal: the colonialist nature of Israel, the racist expansionist policies, and the persistence of Israel in appropriating Palestinian land year after year after year. None of these sound crazy. What do you think?
And there's more. I mean, the memory of the dispossession of the Palestinian remains with every Arab who was born before 48, after 48. This is an issue that's still in the political and popular culture of the Arab people. And also remember, there is a blood record of the state of Israel. I am 60 years old today, and in my own lifetime, Israel has bombed the following countries: Tunisia, Sudan, Egypt, Somalia, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq. And in 1973, Israel ordered the downing of a civilian Libyan airliner. This is in my own lifetime. Israel has bombed all these countries, has bombed refugee camps throughout the region. And I mean, it is only logical, it is only rational that the Arabs do not look kindly at the state of Israel. I mean, early in the 1950s, Hannah Arendt remarked in an article about the Arab-Israeli question, in which she said Zionists, and you can add Americans, under successive administration, have always operated according to the dictum that Arabs only understand the language of force.
Yeah.
And Hannah Arendt said to Zionists, and she was a Zionist herself, right? Hannah Arendt said, even though she was a critic, but she said, if there is any lesson after watching a few years of the Arab-Israeli question, is that the one language that Arabs do not understand is the language of force. I mean, look how much massive violence Israel has inflicted on Arabs in order to subjugate them, in order to subjugate the Palestinian people, to squash their national aspiration, and it hasn't been successful. No matter how much massive violence they use, and no matter how much violence the U.S. does, and no matter how much sanctions is used against the populations. I mean, today, if you contribute money in America to a hospital that is considered affiliated with Hamas, which runs Gaza, I mean, you will serve a long time in jail.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what the Israeli lobby has made. I mean, basically, the Arabs, by this American Zionist alliance, the Arabs are told the following: that if you resist Israel through armed struggle, you are a terrorist. No matter, even if you are only targeting Israeli occupation soldiers, you are a terrorist. And if you decide to resist Israel peacefully and verbally, you are an anti-Semite. I mean, they are giving Arabs no choice, or even support. Not only Arabs. I mean, look at Jeremy Corbyn. Even support of the Palestinians. They are giving up no alternative. BDS has become an anti-Semitic method because it's boycott. I mean, when basically critics of Nazism were the ones who pioneered the art of boycott of German goods.
Right.
I mean, that's what BDS is really about, the peaceful boycott of the state of Israel. And this is why Zionism has become the biggest enemy of freedom of speech in most Western countries. They want to deny us the right to speak out against the state of Israel. And if we do, you are called anti-Semitic.
Yeah, so it's interesting. And I don't want to pass up an opportunity. I mean, in terms of the U.S., we have the same problem with faulty polls year after year. And I include Gallup in that. Number one, they constantly claim that because they can find some support for Israelis over Palestinians in the U.S., that U.S. Americans also support massive aid packages to Israel. And what we found is that those claims cannot be supported. And so despite debunking 30 years of Gallup polls and doing statistically significant polls where most people don't have an opinion, that is the majority opinion, is they don't want to take sides. We still hear year after year from Gallup that Americans support U.S. aid to Israel. They also, by the way, seem to support their right to free speech to boycott and that movement does not go against the grain. And so this effort that you talk about against Corbyn is obviously happening here as well. It's just a tremendous coordinated campaign. I want to get into a couple more things, though, about the topic of the day, which is, of course, normalization. So one of the other obvious premises, and you've mentioned it a bit, is that normalization has carrots and sticks. You mentioned the sticks, which would be continued sanctions on Sudan if they don't do this. What about some of the carrots, like the F-35 fighter jet sales?
I mean, the United States is willing to use its leverage, and its leverage either is punishment or rewards, in order to achieve its own aims and the aims of the state of Israel. I mean, now we have to be happy that the UAE dictatorship, which has become a regional hegemonic force. I mean, the UAE today is engaged in war crimes from faraway places like Libya, in Yemen. They were involved in Afghanistan. They are now having more advanced weapons given to them. And let us make it very clear. This is not entirely the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. Obama was not less a champion of arming these despots. And let us remember that the Yemeni war, this brutal war, which created the biggest humanitarian crisis today on the face of the earth, according to the United Nations, was brokered by the Obama administration. The Obama administration was the midwife of the war in Yemen. So this attempt by Samantha Power or some of those sudden critics of U.S. foreign policy because right. it's a Republican administration, we remember your roles. We remember Samantha Power's alliance with the Saudi ambassador of the United Nations, and I have the picture to show them.
Well, it's interesting. They basically ran out of bombs to sell right. Saudi Arabia to drop on Yemen, and nobody's talking about that. And it's an incredible lack of understanding about what's going on. So, these normalization deals, and you raised this issue, the Abraham Accords Peace Agreement, Treaty of Peace, Diplomatic Relations, and Full Normalization between UAE and State of Israel, that's the formal title of it, raise the question exactly, and I think you may have already answered this, but have the UAE and Israel ever really been at war in any sense of the word?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. I was just about to speak about that because I made in Arabic on social media about that. Because not only they never were enemies before, but they were also collaborators under the table. But the funniest statement to me was the statement by the foreign minister of the UAE, who is the brother of the ruler and the half-brother of the other ruler. I mean, how it works over there. And he made a statement in which he said, "We are tired of war. We have been exhausted." And of course, young Arabs on social media were making fun of that guy. Because what has he done against Israel? What was his contribution or the contribution of his ancestors in the wars against Israel? Of course, they were zero.
Right.
But this is a myth that is being woven by the Western media as well, not only the government. I mean, the Western media, look how they label these peace accords. You know, long-time enemies are
right. Finally coming to the bargaining table, right?
They want to make it more of an achievement in right. order to basically enhance the credentials of the state of Israel. That Israel is winning friends. I mean, they do something similar when they speak about the Israeli alliance with the Sunni Arab world. I mean, what Sunni Arab world? Call them Sunni despot. They should not even be called Sunni despot. They should be called despot because, I mean, they do not speak on behalf of any people, whether they are Sunni or non-Sunni or whatever. These are despots who are self-elected, selected, and they are only there because they are supported by the United States. I mean, Trump at least was honest during his campaign, but not afterwards, when he said those despots would not have stayed in power all these years if it wasn't for direct U.S. support.
Well, yes. And he was also there in the White House at the giant list of military hardware that exactly. you know MBS was going to buy. So there was a refreshing honesty about the craven nature of a lot of this. And, you know, the arms seem to be the carrot, but I guess we need to get into the biggest questions, which are, what does the U.S. get out of any of this? Is the U.S. role simply to be kind of a cat's paw for Israeli and Sunni Arab designs? I mean, what does the U.S. get out of any of this?
I mean, Sunni Arab designs have nothing to do with that. It's all about it's all about Israel. And it just happens that these, you know, Sunni rulers, Sunni in name, rulers, you know, are making peace with Israel, and that pleases U.S. Congress. I mean, notice that there is a bipartisan support for any peace agreement between the Arab despots and the state of Israel. I mean, Nancy Pelosi went even farther. She even expressed concern about selling to the UAE, not because the UAE is committing war crimes in Yemen, not because it's committing war crimes in Libya, but she said she is worried about Israel. Yeah. Israel is a state that is guaranteed the military and technological superiority, not only against one Arab enemy, but against all Arab enemies. I mean, assuming that those despots are enemies. I mean, the only enemy that Israel has in the region are the people. And it is for that reason Israel and the U.S. will do their utmost to subvert the will of the people. Look what's happening in Sudan. In Sudan, after the uprising of last year, there was an arrangement whereby the military junta supported by the U.S. and Israel told the civilian civic group in Sudan, we will rule together in an arrangement. But this arrangement now is being exposed and being fractured because it has become very clear that the military junta has no intention of sharing power with the civic group of Sudan, not with the political parties that revolted or the youth groups. They want to monopolize power and do the bidding of Israel and the United States. And this is why there is rising criticism. There's a crisis in Sudan today. And it is for the bidding of Israel that the U.S. Congress acts. And Donald Trump knew that because of the failure of the Jared Kushner plan for the Middle East, let's call it that, the deal of the century, which went
deal of the century,
after a few days of its announcement. Because of that failure, the Trump administration needed something to point to. They needed a kind of a diplomatic achievement to brag about. And they knew, and they were right, that at least this is an achievement, between quotation marks, that even Democrats, even the stalwart Democratic critics of Trump, would not dare utter a word in its criticism, even though they are deserving of criticism, because, of course, Democrats are as cowardly about criticizing Israeli apartheid and war crimes as Republicans are.
I just want to mention something that, in terms of the good guys doing some polls, that the Washington Report published a poll we ran, and it showed basically that 68% of Americans, if they were given kind of the same deal of the century of either taking an economic plan if they were driven out of their homes and properties, or fighting for return, most Americans would have never accepted the deal of the century when purely given the question on terms of what it actually is. So no surprise that the region and that the Palestinians wouldn't accept it. But I guess, you know, here at the end, we have to talk about the Biden administration. Over at one of these nodes of the Israel lobby, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, they're heavily pushing the idea that Saudi Arabia's got to normalize next, and that this is their last chance to kind of lock in this relationship, this unquestioning relationship of economic and military relations with the U.S., that if they normalize with Israel, the Biden administration's going to leave them alone. What do you think the Biden administration's going to be doing in the immediate months about normalization?
On the subject of normalization?
Yeah.
Well, I think that, no question about it, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, is facing domestic trouble of different kinds. He has problems within royal families. He has put most of his cousins under house arrest, his uncles under house arrest. The king is, for all intents and purposes, is under house arrest, watched at all times by people who are loyal to the crown prince. And so he has to worry about his ability to daringly defy all the traditions of the royal family and crown himself as king. It is a tall order that he is worried about doing it. And it is for that reason that he has hesitated. He has been hesitating to make it official as of this point. But he knows politics of Washington, D.C. very well. Let me give you a scenario, Grant. If Mohammed bin Salman were to fly, just like Anwar Sadat in 1977, into occupied Palestine, and if he were to deliver a speech calling for peace in the Israeli Knesset, do you have doubts that liberal and Democrats in the media, conservative and Democrats, you know, all sides, that everybody in Congress, even Bernie Sanders, will praise this initiative of the Crown Prince? I have no doubt. Personally, I mean, I know there are a lot of fans of Bernie Sanders. Personally, I don't think there would be one voice of dissent in showering praise on Mohammed bin Salman if he were to take that step. And I think personally, knowing what I know about the Saudi government,
yeah,
it's probably something that he is considering. And it is for that reason he arranged for this secret meeting, not so secret meeting, I should say.
Yeah, the secret meetings are not secret, right?
He is trying to preempt the Biden administration by polishing his pro-Israeli credentials. And yeah, the Biden administration, in my mind, will not mind normalizing with MBS in return for normalization. And I'm sure they will make some cosmetic solution regarding the murder of Khashoggi. Like they will say, we beheaded two or three people that we thought were responsible and so on. Something like that. A face-saving formula for both sides. And all will be gone to past times. And let us remember that Joe Biden has been in this business for a very long time. Yeah. And he has kissed and hugged a lot of despots in the Middle East, and he will go back doing that, just as Obama did, just as Trump did.
On that happy note, we have to end. You have been listening to California State University Professor Asad Khalil in discussion with Grant Smith of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at the same time every week. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى